I think the mountains, and especially for me, Mount Everest, is a great metaphor for anything great that we dare in life. It's only then that I understood why so many people look up at Everest with such incredible admiration and with such passion. Because when you sit there and you look out across the world, it's incredible. There's something so godly about it. You really feel like you're the closest place to heaven.
Join explorers and travelers on their journeys and discover distant places and fascinating cultures. From the highest peaks and densest jungles into the heart of adventure, this is Unfolding Maps with Eric Lawrence.
Mount Everest in the Himalayas, Mount Vinson in Antarctica, only two of the highest mountains on each of the seven continents. The former Vogue fashion editor and today's extreme mountaineer, Helga Henke, was the first German woman ever to successfully climb them all. She has experienced challenges that could not be more diverse. From the deep silence of Antarctica to the Stone Age of Papua, through rainforests and enormous snowstorms, up to the airy heights of steep summit ridges. In this episode, we talk about some of these adventures. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Hello, Helga. Welcome to Unfolding Maps. I'm very glad that you're here.
Hi.
So I would like to start with the beginning and with a question. When was the very first time that you heard of the Himalayas?
Of the Himalayas? That was really early in life.
Yes.
Surprisingly, because that was, we had moved from Chicago to Munich, and it was the first time I met my grandparents, and they had just returned from a trekking expedition in the Himalayas, and they showed us the pictures, like old-fashioned way with a slideshow onto the wall. And I remember how fascinated I was with those images of those monks, the red-robed monks walking through like little monasteries and all these prayer flags and those golden prayer wheels that they were turning, and the especially the Tibetans. The Tibetans looked really wild. Wild hair, long hair, frizzy, and they had these big sheepskin jackets, and they were driving their animals, these huge shaggy cows called yaks, across the highlands. And I remember my grandfather was talking about Everest and Himalayas and this and Buddhism and all these incredible treasures that they found there. And I remember when we drove home, I thought, when I'm big, I'm going to move to the Himalayas.
You wanted to move there?
Yes, yes. I wanted to live there.
Why? Why was it so impactful?
It was so different. And so it looked like it was incredibly free there. And you could just roam and go. And I was really, really fascinated.
And I think you were also fascinated, I don't know if that was the same conversation you had with your grandparents, of a photo that showed the summit of Mount Everest, right?
Yes, it showed my grandparents sitting at the just above base camp on the Nepalese side of Everest. And the mountain was really big above them, high above.
Really looming.
And it had a white cloud trailing from its summit.
As it often does.
Because it touches the jet streams. And I asked my grandmother why it had that cloud, because all the other mountains didn't have any clouds. And she said it's because the goddess lives up there, and when she's happy, she starts dancing, and then she twirls up all the snow, and that makes the cloud. And I remember, yeah, I also thought, I wasn't sure that she was not, I wasn't sure if it was really true. So I thought maybe one day I will go and see if that's really true. I couldn't really imagine a goddess living up there, but she said it very, with great confidence.
It's a nice story at
least. Yeah,
yes,
it was
right.
A great story. Yeah. And that's what the Tibetans actually believe. They believe that goddess Myo Lung Zangmo lives up there. That's her realm. And that's why before you climb Mount Everest, you celebrate a puja, asking her for permission to climb to the summit.
Did these stories by your grandparents, did they awake a lifelong interest and passion for mountains and for Nepal and so on? Was this a topic that accompanied you throughout your childhood and your youth?
Not at all. Yes. Not at all. My parents were not climbers at all. And we saw my grandparents, I think, two or three more times. We were not very close with them. And we saw on a couple of other expeditions that they came from, usually from Tibet or from the Andes in Peru. And I remember I was always really fascinated. But then I was in school, and after school I wanted to move to New York. I got into fashion, and I completely forgot about the idea I had when I was a little girl. And it returned to me really late. When I was, I had just finished my studies in New York at the university. And I was suddenly drawn into different directions that I didn't. I was working quite successfully as a fashion editor. I had finished my studies in film, marketing, and philosophy. I didn't know how I was going to combine those two. I suddenly had a lot of free time on my hands because my school was finished. And that's where I remembered that I had a dream when I was a little girl. And then I started very small rock climbing on the climbing wall in my fitness studio.
In New York?
In New York, yeah.
Which is not an obvious thing to do in New York, right? So how came this new spark of interest in climbing even on this smaller level?
I went to the fitness studio for yoga.
Yes.
And when I was in the
yoga
class,
that's more typical to New York.
That's more typical New York, especially in the fashion business. You try to calm down and center yourself and relax. And they built a climbing wall at the back of the studio, and it looked incredible. And all those boys were there climbing through the wall. It was 10 meters up, straight up. Then it had a roof for 6 meters out and another 6 meters up. It was incredible. When you see that, I mean, it wasn't so known then. It wasn't so popular to go rock climbing. And I looked at that and I thought, wow, and how they climbed through the ceiling upside down. And I asked them if I can try. Then I went there every night. And the Seven Summits I found when I went to a local bookstore, Barnes & Noble's at the Union Square. And it was a Saturday, I remember, early in the morning, and I went there, and I was looking for a climbing guide that was a guide to upstate New York where you could go real rock climbing outside on the rocks. But I couldn't find it, and when I had time, so I took all those mountaineering books with me and found myself one of those big leather chairs. I sat myself down, and I remember I was looking through all these huge, beautiful books like about the Rocky Mountains and the Himalayan Giants and this blue Alaska light that was in the Alaskan mountains. And then I found a smaller book. It was called The Seven Summits, The Highest Mountain, or The Challenge of Climbing the Highest Mountain on Each Continent. I was like, on each continent? There is high mountains on each continent? I had no idea. I'd never even heard of it before.
Yeah.
It was by Dick Bass. And then I started reading through the book, and I followed Dick Bass on his adventures from Aconcagua in South America to Antarctica, Mount Vincent, then Kilimanjaro in Africa, which that's the one I heard about before. Of course, Everest, and then the Carson's Pyramid, and which one am I missing? And Elbrus for Europe. Yeah, and it was fascinating. I mean, he went through rainforests and steep north faces and up on these elusive summit ridges through horrible winter storms. And I was like, what an incredible adventure to go to each continent and climb the highest peak and touch the sky. And I also thought in my imagination that from the summit, of course, you can see the whole continent. You can see the whole land. And and I remember I went home that afternoon with the book under my arm, thinking, it's never going to be the Seven Summits, because Everest, you had to be born, bred mountaineer, which I wasn't. I was 29.
And you have to have a big beard.
And you have the big beard. Yes, and, yeah, all the grisliness of a mountain hero, which obviously I didn't have. I had just started climbing. But I thought the six summits, I could imagine really well doing the six summits in my first overflowing enthusiasm. And then I started out with Aconcagua.
How do you explain this confidence? Was it only naivety? I mean, you were a fashion editor in New York, very successful. Yeah. You worked for Vogue and other magazines. Yeah. And yeah, you had 1 or 2 years of experience in rock climbing in a studio. So
I had a 3-4 months experience in rock climbing.
Less. Okay, by then, when you found the book. Okay.
It was way forward. Yeah. That's what my mom asked me.
Yes.
And she still asks me, how did you have the confidence to do that?
Or to believe that you potentially could do it.
Yes. I didn't think too much about it. I thought Aconcagua, it said in the book that Aconcagua was not difficult. It was really hard, but it was not technically difficult.
Yeah, no technical climbing.
Challenging.
Yes.
You could take your dog to the summit. It said in my guidebook. I thought, if you can take your dog to the summit, then I can go to the summit. And I thought, colder than New York in the winter is not possible. And if you've been to New York in the winter, it's really, really, really cold. I mean, the wind drives through those streets. So I thought, and with altitude, I had no idea how I should imagine altitude. I mean, there's something that most people can't imagine, and you just have to go and see how you do. And I didn't have any... I found an expedition outfit, and I talked with the guide, and he said, of course you can do that. You need 6 months of training. He sent me a training schedule. I had to run every morning, go to the fitness studio with weights in my backpack on the stepping machine. I was really fit anyway through yoga, but I mean, I added a couple of fitness levels. And then he told me to buy all these things that I needed for the expedition, sleeping bag and boots and shopping. I mean, I was really used to going shopping, so that was easy for me. And then I went. And when some people around me or friends, they said, well, what are you going to do if you can't do it, if it's too difficult? I said, well, then I'll turn around and come back home. At least, you know, I want to try. I want to see the fascination these people have, why they go and talk about mountains with these, with eyes that are like
gleaming,
on fire, yeah, gleaming. Yes. And I thought, I have nothing to lose. I'm going to go. It was over Christmas, so I didn't have to book any extra holiday, and I just went there. And it was incredible. It was even more fun than I thought it would be. And it was a lot harder than I thought it would be.
That's what I wanted to say.
It was a lot colder than I thought it would be. And my first encounter with high altitude was horrible.
Where did you encounter it consciously? On which height and how?
Between base camp and the first camp, between 4,200 meters and about 5,000 meters, I was walking. I had been doing really well with altitude because we had approached it really slowly, just by coincidence. And then it was the first time setting out above 5,000 meters. And I started walking in the morning. When the others stopped to drink something, I would carry on because I thought then they can catch up with me later when I start getting slower. I didn't eat anything. I didn't feel hungry. And about 5,000 meters, I suddenly hit a wall. It was like, bam! I sat down on the gravel, crying. I had the worst headache you can imagine. It just came over me like... It must have started earlier, but I didn't feel it. I thought a little headache. What's the problem? It was really horrible. 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 I sat there like a child crying in the gravel slope until the climbing guide came. And he tried to get me to eat and drink, but I was so sick already that I couldn't. I just thinking about having to eat something or drink something, made me feel more sick. And then he carefully gave me some liquid, very small little sips of tea, and brought me back to life. Yeah. And I remember my mind was completely clouded because I remember very well I made him kneel down with a hand on his heart, promise that I never have to eat anything in my whole life anymore, ever. Only then would I try and drink more and go back down to base camp with him. And he did that. He realized she is out of her mind. No use reasoning with her. He swore I would never have to eat anything. We went back down to base camp. By the time we got back down to 4,000 meters, of course, I was hungry. And the problem was solved.
And you turned around also in your head and found new strength. So you didn't give up, obviously.
No, I didn't give up. And I had there was an older climbing guide who came to my rescue, and he said, "You have to leave your ego behind. You cannot stomp out of base camp trying to be first and trying to get there fast. You walk slowly. You go behind all the others. Every half an hour you drink something, you eat a little piece, even if you don't feel hungry, and you take it step by step. You don't have to race ahead." I said, "Leave your ego behind. That's the secret of high altitude climbing."
After he told you that, was it easy for you to switch the switch in your head? I completely switched.
I said, "Okay, I'm not going to be first today. I'm going to be last.
Yes.
And I'm going to try everything to be last, and then I'm going to succeed." And that was exactly the trick. The trick is to find a rhythm, to go slow, to take your time, to look inside and feel your body, like we do at yoga. I mean, it was nothing different than taking a yoga class in New York and trying to calm down, feel your breath, concentrate on your breath, and leave your ego out.
What else did you learn on the ascent, on the way up? Was there more that surprised you about the expedition life, maybe, about the life in the camps?
It was really simple. I had been traveling around the whole world as a fashion editor. You always do the photo shoots on the most strangest locations around the world, usually at opposite end of the world because you have the different seasons. But it was always really nice. Everything was very pampered. We had location managers and catering and everything. And on the mountain, it was different. You sleep on a thin mattress in your tent with a sleeping bag, and there's no shower, there's no hot bathtub. You just have to make do with very, very simple, natural life. And I was surprised how much fun it is, how easy it is, and how little you need to be happy, really.
So it was very easy for you to get used to it.
It was fun. It was like being a child again, I think, of making do with very simple things and having your own little house with your sleeping bag. And it's incredible. At first, you think you need a nice toilet and you need a nice shower, but actually you don't. You don't. It's not necessary. It's very, it can be very, relaxing to go simple.
How relaxing was it to actually reach the summit?
It was not relaxing at all.
What was the state that you were in when you reached it?
I did quite well that day, actually. I started out having a hard time in the night because we started out at just after midnight, and I was really, really cold. I had made the mistake to put my inner boots inside my sleeping bag and sleep inside with my feet inside my inner boots. Because I thought if I have to go to the bathroom, then I don't have to put on so many things. I can quickly go and come back. But the problem was that in the inner boots, my feet started to sweat. My socks got slightly wet. And then when we set out in the morning, I climbed into my outer boots. And when we started walking, it was really, really cold. It was 1 o'clock in the morning. The wind had picked up and it was really cold, above 6,000 meters. And my feet got so cold that I couldn't feel them anymore. And I thought, now they're frozen, they're black, they're going to fall off. And I was in a real panic, and I couldn't keep up with the others because I was so worried about my feet, and also my hands were really cold. And then Bean, our climbing guide, there was a small little, like a wooden hut that was on the side of the trail, like a shelter for if you have a really bad day. And we crawled into it, and he unpacked my feet from my shoes, took off the socks, put new socks on me, and warmed my feet under his down jacket on his belly. And it felt so good. My feet were still white. They were not black, and they came back to life. He massaged them with incredible patience and so much goodwill. And then we stepped out and continued into the night. And when we got out, the horizon was just separating. It was the first light came up and the wind was dying down. And then we stepped into the Canaletta. The Canaletta is a huge, about 500 altimeters, like a huge wall that you have to climb through. It's rocks, rolling rocks piled on top of one another. It's like a huge gravel pit that you have to climb up.
A slope. So
a slope.
A steep slope. It's not technical climbing,
slope,
but...
No, it's a steep slope, and every second step you take, you kind of scoot back down to where you started from. It's horribly frustrating. But it keeps you warm because you have to move.
Yes.
So you're constantly... I was crawling on all fours sometimes, and sometimes on 2 feet, and I just kept going and going and going until we reached the top. It's brutal. But it's not brutal that it's technically and difficult. It's challenging your mind. It's like you can really feel your inner, your determination and your inner willpower. And you challenge that with every step. And you can feel, is it there or is it not there? So if you ever want to see how much you have inside you, it's Canada is the perfect place to go and find out how much courage and determination you have.
What is your self-talk like in these moments? How do you encourage yourself to move on?
I usually start counting steps. I just count steps. I would pretend that I was blowing up balloons because you have to breathe so hard. There's so little oxygen in the air. And then I match the balloons to the colors of the other climbers' jackets. And you play all kinds of tricks in your mind. You say, I usually say to myself, I said 25 steps and I'm not going to look up until I have 25 steps. And after 50 steps, I'm going to turn around and look down and see how much I've achieved already. And then I do another 25 steps. It's like games you play with yourself, with your mind to just keep going with tedious work. Yeah, I do it on all the mountains. And it's funny because Aconcagua was so difficult that on many other mountains, I would also start into that mode of having to count my steps. And I would think, this is not as bad as Aconcagua was. This is still easier.
So it was really a kind of baptism of fire. And after that, it got not on all the mountains, but on many mountains, it got easier.
Yes.
Yes, nice. Yeah, how was it to reach the summit in this case, your first big summit?
That was incredible. It's incredible because when you top out of the Canaletta, it's the summit.
Mm-hmm.
And then suddenly you turn around and you look around and around and it's just blue sky.
But you realized you don't see the whole continent, actually.
No, you don't see that. you see across all the different ridges and other mountain segments. And I think we thought that we also saw the ocean, the Pacific Ocean. And we saw a lot. I mean, it was a really, really good day. And, maybe we saw Antarctica even. It was far down, but at least we thought we did, yeah.
Was this a moment when you knew that this would be kind of a path that you would continue to follow?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah.
Why?
I knew. I remember how proud I was. Mm-hmm. I was so proud. Summit is only halfway and you have to go back down to base camp, but I had met a whole group of Swiss climbers and some English climbers. I mean, they're all at the same time on the same mountain because every mountain has a season. And so you meet all the other climbers and they were all, of course, more experienced and they had more mountains under their belt. So I was really the new kid on the block or something. And they had all been really nice and had been encouraging and said, oh, you have to do this. And everybody gave me tips. And I was so proud that I made it that I just wanted to run down and tell everybody that I did it. That they actually, their tips had actually helped me and that I succeeded and that I finally, I felt like I belonged with them now, that I had achieved something that was, I thought was really something very special.
How did your passion for mountaineering develop from there on?
From there, there was a Swiss mountain guide. They were our neighbors and they had invited me a couple of times. They were really nice. And he invited me when we came back down. He said, oh, you know, I'm going to go to Peru for a trio of mountains, 3 6,000-meter peaks. If you want to come, I will send you all the information and it would be great to have you on the team. And then I went with him and then I met someone else and I met someone else. And on every mountain I kept meeting people and they invited me, or they told me, oh, we're going to this mountain. I thought, oh, that sounds really great. And I looked into it and I signed up for the same expedition. It kind of just snowballs from there.
And how did the idea of aiming at Everest come about?
That took a long time.
Yes, because you said in the beginning you thought this is completely out of the question.
Yeah, that was out of the question for a long time. Yes. For a long time. I went, I climbed Aconcagua, then a couple of months later I went to Peru to do a couple 6,000 meter peaks for the first time in snow and on ice, mm-hmm. which I did quite well, I think, with a lot of help from my team. And then I went for the first time to the Himalayas, to the south side of Everest, to do a trekking round. That was a year later. And that was the first time I was at Everest Base Camp, where my grandparents had been. And yes. I thought,
how was that?
It was amazing, amazing, amazing. I knew when I was there, when I was standing there watching the summit, that one day I would have to be one of those climbers. I knew. I had this picture in my mind. I had read a lot of articles, of course, and books about it. And there was always these heavily clad in big down suits, climbers with their goggles. And in the goggles, you could see the Himalayas reflecting and the peak, the summit. And they were leaning over their ice axe and breathing heavily and with the oxygen mask. And it just looked, and when I stood there, I thought, one day I will have to be one of them. I will have to be one of those people who are trying to reach the summit of Everest. I knew it was far away. It was going to take me many, many years and a lot of dedicated climbing before I was had enough experience to do that.
And one day, I think, a Spanish lady, she helped with motivation and encouragement.
That's true. She was the first one who actually... who actually gave me the idea that I could probably, that I was not so far away from yes. climbing Everest. Or not Everest, but a smaller 8,000 meter peak. I was working for, Condé Nast for Vogue, and there was a magazine, it was called Sports and Fitness. It was like a younger Vogue, sporty one. And, they chose me to do a fashion shoot with this woman. She's a Spanish woman, Aracela Segarri. She was the first Spanish woman to climb Everest. And she was part of a movie that came out then. It was the first 3D movie on climbing Everest by David Brashears.
IMAX movie, right?
Yeah, it was yes. an IMAX movie. That's what yes. it was, not 3D. It was an IMAX movie. And they said, oh, Helga is going to do the shoot because she knows. She can dress her in some nice gowns, but also in the climbing gear. So they sent me to do the shoot. And I remember I was really looking forward. I thought there was going to be some grizzly woman coming into the studio.
You know, I was with a cold brief coming in.
Yeah. what is she going to wear? Is she going to fit into my nice evening robes? And I was so surprised when she walked in. Is this beautiful, petite woman who was, I mean, she could have just been any one of the models that we usually had. She was really cute and funny, and she gave me her hand and said, hi, I'm Araceli, and so great to meet you. And it didn't take any persuasion to put her into the nice evening gowns with the high heels. She said, oh, it's no problem on Everest to go with the crampons across the ladders. You know, she went on the south side of Everest to cross the ladders with crampons. She said, oh, that was not a problem because I'm really good at walking in high heels anyway. And she was really funny all day. And she told us about how she had been cutting the hair of the other expedition members. She said she's a really bad haircutter, but it didn't matter because they wore hats anyway, and they didn't have any mirrors to look at what she had done to them. And I remember when she left the studio, I looked after her and I thought, if she can do that, I can do that. It was probably really obnoxious, but I suddenly had the feeling if that's what it takes, that you have to be gracious and fun about it, and there's so much life on Everest, then I can also do that.
And you didn't know at this point of time that no German woman has ever achieved to climb Everest successfully and come down successfully.
No, I didn't know. I didn't know the German climbing world because I was not in that. I was in the American climbing world, so I had no idea. And then I signed up. I worked with her in the spring, and then in the fall, I signed up for my first 8,000-meter peak. I thought, I'm ready now. I'm going to do this. I always had the idea, if it's too hard, I'm just going to go back home. You know, I always thought I can always go. I mean, I don't have to
reach the
summit. That always made it really easy for me. I didn't have sponsors. I worked. And then when I had enough money, I went on the next expedition. And it was my free will, my freedom, that anytime I didn't like it, I could always return back home. And that made it easy.
Did this make you feel very safe about it? Because many people would probably say before they attempt to climb Everest, if it gets too tough, if it gets too dangerous, if the weather turns back, I will just turn around. But then many people die.
Because they don't turn around. Yeah. I think that's the challenge with anything great you do in life. Anything, doesn't matter, mountains or deserts or the water or whatever. Anything great you do. I think you should always have the liberty to go back home. Or you should allow yourself that liberty. And it has a lot to do with ego. Because a lot of times I think we don't dare something because we're not sure that we're going to make it. We have such a high expectation of ourselves to be successful that we don't want to attempt something that we cannot be 100% sure that we can actually achieve. Which I think is wrong. Because you're never going to go beyond or do something really special if you always attempt something only when you're sure that you can make it. I think we're safe. We can dare. We can go out and we can change our minds. I think those are two things. And maybe that's what I learned in my philosophy classes. We had a professor and he said, we're safe now. We can change our minds. And I think that's very liberating.
Yes.
You suddenly feel, okay, I can try. And if I don't succeed, I can come back home. And then either I try harder next time or prepare myself better, or I find something else where I'm more gifted.
How do you make this decision? Because I think one success factor is also in general in life, not to give up too early. And probably it's the same on the mountain. You don't want to give up too early.
Yeah,
so
that's the same.
What do you look out for?
It was Russell on Everest who gave me that idea. I remember there were a couple of times I was sitting in base camp in tears in my tent thinking, this is too hard, too cold, too difficult, and I'm not as strong and grizzly as the other members in my team. I'm never going to make it. And then you fall into that self-indulgent pity of yourself, which is horrible. And I remember he came to my tent and he said, Helga, you can always go home, but you should do that only when you are sure that you have given your best. You owe that to the mountain and you owe that to the idea with which you started into this adventure. And I think he was right. Often all it took was another good night's sleep, and waking up in the morning thinking, okay, one more time. I'm going to try one more time to give my best. And if I don't succeed, then I'm going to go home. And I think it's the small steps that we have to focus on when we're not feeling so good and not this huge mountain that is hanging like a Damoclean sword above us.
You mentioned a couple of times you are not a grizzly woman. You are, you know, more easygoing, more nimble. But when you had moments of self-doubt, of course, you realized you are not a grizzly woman. Yeah. And you thought, maybe that makes me weak, or at least too weak.
Yeah.
Was this also something that you encountered, these kinds of doubts from other team members on any of your expeditions? That because in an expedition, you are a team, you depend on each other.
Yeah.
Did they ever react negatively when they saw you and you are a slim woman, you don't look like a grizzly.
Roughy, toughy mountaineer. Yeah. I can't say, I don't think they ever discriminated against me. They, I always had the feeling they welcomed me really with quite open arms into the team. I mean, surely I didn't look the way a mountain hero should look like or in your imagination, but...
Also, they knew that this is not what is important.
They were also really nice. I had, on the first Himalayan trip, they called me Barbie girl because they would always, man, I'm Barbie girl, when I walked into the kitchen tent or something. I didn't mind. I mean, I came from Barbie world, so I didn't mind. There was nothing strange about it for me. It was okay. And it sheltered me because I thought they didn't expect too much of me. So I was okay. I was in a safe place. I knew in the beginning I had a hard time with acclimatization, and it was good for me to lay back and to pretend I'm not as good and as grisly as they are and not immediately step into the competition.
Yes.
Which is quite difficult amongst the men. When they are equally grisly, they are in incredible competition amongst each other. And that makes it hard. And I usually picked up more speed later in the expedition. When I finally found the acclimatization and I started slowly, I would do much better above 6,000 meters or above 7,000 meters. It's something I discovered. That gave me a lot of confidence. And I always thought if they doubted me or looked at me like, oh, maybe Helga, maybe you stay behind today and help out in the kitchen. I would say, you wait. I'm going to overtake you up there and you're going to be so surprised. I wouldn't say that, but I would think that. And a lot of times it happened like that. Altitude is an incredible equalizer because in the beginning, the stronger ones fare better. But later, when acclimatization phase is over, the weaker looking ones have a good chance of faring better.
Because it's not about muscle power.
It's about muscle power. It's about balance and staying with yourself and not overpowering yourself, but taking step by step and leaving your ego behind. That's what it is about. And that is sometimes hard for the grizzly mountaineers.
Which route did you choose to climb Mount Everest?
I went on the north side of Everest. It's a bit lesser known. It's less. It's not as successful, not as popular as the south side route, the Nepalese route.
It's supposed to be a little bit more difficult and dangerous.
It's supposed to be. They say, I've never been on the south side, I can't really compare, but the success rate is a lot less, and it is not as popular. It is technically more challenging, colder, steeper, windier, but it is the safer route to get to the summit. That's what Russell said, and that's what a lot of climbing expedition leaders say, because you don't have the Khumbu ice fall that you have to go through. You don't have the ladders, you don't have this objective dangers on the mountain. So it's really just you. And also there's not as many people there, which makes it easier, I think. So I went on the north side because I really wanted to go with Russell and with his team.
And that was his plan, so you just had to go along.
He would only do the north side back then, and I really liked him. I liked his style of leadership on the mountain, and I liked his Sherpas. I felt really comfortable. I think that's probably the most important thing on an expedition, to choose your team, the ones you feel comfortable with, the style of leadership you feel comfortable with. If someone is a nightmare and you always have to doubt his decisions and you don't feel comfortable around your boss on the mountain, then I think you should find another boss or another team. So that was the main reason why I went on the north side, which was good. I really liked it. It's challenging. Technically was not difficult for me because I come from technical climbing, and I liked the diversity on the mountain. It's so different. Every day is different, and that makes it really nice and exciting.
And you spent 2 months on the north side, right? 2 months is what the whole expedition took?
Yes. Yeah.
So what did you do in this time?
Well, you arrive after 10 days traveling, you arrive at base camp, 5,000 meters, and on the north side is really comfortable because you can drive there by jeep. Everything arrives, yes. And then you spend about a week at base camp climbing lesser mountains around base camp to get a good view of the north face and to get to know the team, to acclimatize yourself. And then you start up to advanced base camp, 6,400 meters. You set up there. you start climbing up to camp one, setting up the tents, come back down to base camp, spend some days relaxing, just in camp, played a lot of cards. I was helping a lot in the kitchen and making pancakes and just keeping myself busy and getting to know the Sherpas. And then you go up to camp two, you come back down to base camp, you go up to camp one, camp two, camp three, set up the tents, come back down. So you're constantly moving on the mountain. You're moving up, you're moving down, you get to know the route, you set out the tents, prepare yourself, get yourself acclimatized, and then that takes about 4 or 5 weeks. And then all high camps are set up. It's 4 high camps above the 2 base camps. The highest one is at 8,300 meters. And then you wait for a weather window. The weather window usually comes around the second, third week of May. It's like it's the advancing monsoon that pushes the jet streams up into a higher place. And it leaves the summit relatively warm and wind still. And it's exactly the window, 3, 4, 5 days that
each
we're
year,
looking for.
Very short window.
Every year. It's yes. just in May.
That and, is probably the explanation why nowadays sometimes the summit is so crowded.
Yes. Now more than, I was there 20 years ago, it was not as crowded. It was already, we were already thinking it's quite crowded on the mountain, but it was, of course, not as crowded as today. And the weather forecast has gotten better and better. The more data those computers can turn over and the easier it is to watch the jet stream with more data available, the better it is to predict the perfect day for Everest. And now you can predict with almost 100%
certainty
the perfect summit day. And of course, most people want to go not in the 75% day or 60% day, but they all strive to go for the 100% day. That's why it gets so crowded. But it's usually only 1 or 2 days, a year. A year. It's less than 1,000 climbers climbing Everest a year. That's not very much. That's what they climb Zugspitze every day. Mm. So in comparison, it looks like a lot, but it's not very many.
How did you spend these many days in the camps? You said you... You helped the Sherpas cooking. Probably you got to know some of them really well.
Yeah, I spent a lot of time with the Sherpas in the kitchen. I really liked being there. It was warm. I liked making pancakes with Lachu. He was our cooking chief. And it was really warm and really nice there. I felt very comfortable with the Sherpas. But my team members, we also sat around. We played cards and we discussed how we're going to succeed and made plans and discussed the plan and it was more strategic meetings with my team members and with the Sherpas. It was usually more fun.
More chit chat.
Yes. They would tell stories and about the Yeti and about, different myths and legends from old times, from the mountain and from the Himalayas. And I always really liked that. They were more like my grandparents were, how they told stories about the mountain.
Why were they on the mountain, they themselves?
The Sherpas?
Yes. Have the feeling that they also do this with their own passion? Or is it that they have to feed their family and this is the best chance to do it, to earn some money in a short period of time? Or were there different stories that stuck out to you?
The Sherpas are a tribe. Mm-hmm. They come from Tibet and they moved into Darjeeling and into the Solukhumbu, which is in Nepal on the south side of Everest, about 450 years ago. And they settled there. And they were farmers, high altitude farmers. And then they started working on expeditions very early on. In the 1920s already, they went on the north side of Everest for the first attempts on Everest. And people found out that they were really good at altitude because they already lived really high. And the Sherpas that are climbing Everest right now is really an elite. They are incredibly, incredibly strong climbers. They have done a long apprenticeship training from kitchen boy to porter to high altitude climbing and then high altitude climbing guide. And they are really the specialists on the mountain. They are really, it's really an elite. And of course they go they are just like we are in our jobs. We want to do a really good job. We want to gain a lot of experience. The more Vogue covers you have, the better stylist you are. The more Everest summits you have, the more money you make as a shipper. So there is the passion for the mountain and for going to the summit and succeeding, and then just work and having to bring home money to feed the family. So it's both. It's the same as jobs in our world.
So let's talk a bit about the ascent. You already mentioned that, of course, there is the base camp one, base camp two, and then the, how did you call them? High altitude?
High camps.
Okay. So maybe you just want to start by pointing out some of the highlights or low points of starting to ascend bit by bit.
So you spend the first week at base camp, then you go up to advanced base camp, spend another week, and then you start climbing the mountain. It's really a lot of up and down. You go up, you fight really hard to get to a higher camp, and then you turn around to get back down where you started from. And this is the only way to climb, because next time you will be stronger, you will be more experienced, you will know the route already, you will know how much weight you can carry, how you did at certain points during the ascent. There's some steep ice walls you have to climb through, there is some long undulating hills where it just takes forever to get through. It's like, looks like never ending. And you've devised kind of your own personal strategies on how to get through these challenges that are on the mountain. Mm-hmm. And hopefully you challenged yourself during those times. You challenged yourself to make mistakes, to go beyond your limit or very close to your limit. And hopefully you've also had some good days, but also some bad days. Because only on the bad days you really learn something. Like sometimes I started too fast, too much weight in my backpack. And then after 2 hours, I just had to turn around because I was completely exhausted. Lesson learned, not too much weight in my pack, maybe less breakfast in the morning, slower start. So this is really the time, those 3-4 weeks on the mountain, is to learn. Mm-hmm. To learn, how am I dealing with altitude? How am I dealing with the cold? How am I dealing with the egos in my team? Where do I fit in? Who is the right person to go with on the mountain, and which people you better stay away from because they drive you on too much or you walk too fast when you go with them. So this is the time to get to know the team and strengths and weaknesses. And then for the summit, you have to be prepared. You have to be ready to know exactly how far you can go. I mean, on summit day, you have to know your turnaround time. That's probably the most important thing to know on the mountain. You have to know, when have I reached half? Because the summit is only halfway. And as you go up, you have to know that you can also comfortably come back down to base camp, come back down to life, because there's no rescue on the mountain. There's no helicopters, no shipper team that can carry you down if you can't move by yourself anymore. And on Everest, I think 90% of the climbers who die on Everest die after they reach the summit because they cannot make their way back down, because they are too exhausted on their way back down, and they just sit down and never find the strength to get back up.
And then they will stay there.
And then they will stay there and die.
And you saw these people,
last season,
right?
It was, I think, 11 people died on Everest, and 10 of them died on their way down from the summit. So there is really only one mistake you can make on Everest, and that is overestimating your strength. It sounds so easy that all you have to do is know when is halftime. It's so difficult when you're so close. When it's like only 2 more hours to the summit, you feel like you reach your arm really long. You can already touch it. After years of training, after 2 months on the mountain of slaving away towards this goal, you suddenly have
investing
to
a lot of money. Yes.
Yeah,
working hard to make it possible.
A lot of money. And you suddenly have to bring out the greatest virtue of all, the virtue of letting go, letting your ego go, and admitting to yourself, today is not my day. And if I don't turn around right now, I'm not going to make it. You have to be so honest with you up there. And it's really hard.
Is this really the only danger, or is there also like technical climbing involved, or like steep parts where you potentially could fall?
Yeah, but it is the same. I mean, there's on the north side, going to the summit is quite steep, and there's a difficult climbing part almost at the very top. But it is the same. Also there, you have to decide, am I strong enough? Am I in the right frame of mind today? Do I have enough breath and energy to make it through this climb safely? I mean, it all has to do with trusting yourself and with knowing your limits.
How can you climb there? Don't you wear thick gloves?
Yeah, you do. You wear thick gloves, you balance. There's a ladder that was hanging there. They have a longer one now, but there was a small ladder. You have to step onto the ladder and then off the ladder again. And below your feet, the north face drops down 3,000 meters all the way down to the glacier. We all know what it takes. We've discussed every move down at base camp. We've learned from the mistakes other climbers have made, hopefully. And then when we get there, we see them. They sit there. They sit there. They lie there. The ones that didn't make it back home. They are a very stark reminder of what will happen if you don't turn around in time. And it's every step you take forward on summit day, you have to listen very deeply into yourself and ask yourself, do I have what it takes with every step? It's very critical. And hopefully you have a shipper with you who takes care of you. And then we also had the added benefit that we had an expedition leader who decided to turn around and not go to the summit with us and monitor our ascent from our progress from base camp. Very carefully, all through the night. And he gave us really good feedback on when we reached which site, how long we took, if he thought we had enough energy, he had a lot of experience, and that was incredibly helpful.
When and how did the summit day start?
We started just after midnight. We had almost full moon standing above the tent, which was really nice because it gave us a lot of light. We could turn the headlamps off, and it's easier to climb just with the light of the moon. It was difficult in the beginning because you come from this lying, when we were lying in the tent for 4, 5, 6 hours,
and just probably resting. Not very cozy.
Well, it's quite cozy. Yeah. You have the big sleeping bag. You're like sardines in the tent. You don't move too much, but you're very kind of, you're not moving. So yes. when you start out, the first thing is to warm up the body, to get moving, to get everything in motion and find a rhythm, take step after step through quite difficult terrain. And you have a heavy backpack. We climb with supplemental oxygen. So I had more than 10 kilos in my backpack, which is quite a lot at that altitude. And, you just keep going step by step. You don't despair when it's too slow because you know you're going to pick up. It's going to be fine. And we climb through steep bands of rock, and then I think the first highlight was when we stepped onto the ridge. For the first time, we stepped onto the north face wall on top of the wall. And it was the first time that we were able to look down over the other side into the Nepalese side of the mountain, Himalayas. And that was incredibly beautiful. We were in teams of two in the night. I was with Luksang. And we had been going really steady and very quickly. And it was the first time that we took a break and we crawled forward very carefully on all fours. It's like a snow drift on the ridge. And we looked down into the east face of Everest, and it was incredibly beautiful. Just the moon was gone and the night was completely dark. And I had the feeling that everybody's sleeping now and we are the only ones watching over the world that night. Was incredibly beautiful,
And I think you also had the chance while walking up to look back once and to really see the beauty of the mountain ranges in the moonlight. Yeah. I remember reading this, I think, in your book, which also seemed like a magic moment.
Very, very. The moon was incredible. It was incredible. So stark and bright and shining this light into the mountain, and all the snow, all these snow patches were glowing, and it sometimes looked like the mountain was glowing from within because the light was so strong. It was really, really beautiful night. Yeah, we were very, very lucky because it was completely windstill. We had really waited for the best day, and it was relatively warm. So
what does it mean, relatively warm?
I think it was about minus 35 when we started, and then it got warmer and warmer as we went up. When the sun came, it was maybe minus 25 on the summit ridge, which is warm in the mountain, especially if there's no wind.
So did you just in quotation marks, steadily walk up there to the summit, or did you encounter any final challenges?
Yeah, the second step. The second step is just when the sun rises, you come to the second step, or we came to the second step, is in the shade. It's a challenging climb. On technical ground, I was really good because I came from rock climbing. So for me, I didn't have a problem there. The others were like more afraid.
Yes.
And took a while longer to fidget around and try to feel more sure about themselves. But for me, that was not a difficult part. I was surprised when we walked to the summit, towards the summit on the last ridge. I mean, you go so slow. It's like a slow motion. When you lift a foot, you put it in front. You lift another foot, put it in front. It's incredibly slow, painfully slow.
Probably feels like forever.
It feels forever. But there's also a lightness in taking those little steps. You look around and around. There's just blue sky around. And the Himalaya is grand in the morning. Hours. I mean, it's so beautiful. I remember when the sun was coming up, we were already sitting in the sun, but we were higher than any other place on earth. So the sun was slowly touching the higher peaks around us, or the lower peaks around us, and then traveling down into the valleys. It's just beautiful. You move in slow motion and you're able to see everything so clearly.
And you were able to enjoy it at this moment, despite the effort it took?
Yeah. That's nice. I think the great advantage on the north side. It's really difficult climbing in the night in the beginning. And once you're up on the ridge, it's not very steep anymore. You kind of just walk. It's almost like a pleasant walk in the morning. It was not the feeling that I thought I would have when I was sitting down at base camp the first time years before. I thought, oh, it's going to be so difficult under my ice axe. I felt much lighter up there. It was not as difficult. And when we approached the summit and Lobsang was standing on the summit, and I said, this is it? This is the summit? I thought it would be much harder to get there. And I was surprised that we had managed to reach it so early in the morning.
And, of course, the obvious question is, what did it feel like to reach it?
It feels incredible. It's just the mountain is suddenly finished. So you're on the top. You're like, and Everest is really special because a very small summit is maybe 2-3 little tables pushed together and everywhere is down. And you can see the curve of the earth on the horizon. It's incredibly beautiful. There was like a small heap of prayer flags that everybody takes up to thank the goddess for a safe passage. And then we were on the summit almost for an hour, just Lobsang and me. And I remember we were just sitting there looking out. You look out like the mountain does, you know, it's like you sit there next to the shrine of her prayer flags and you're just looking out. And it feels like, I think it's only then that I understood why so many people look up at Everest with such incredible admiration and with such passion. Because when you sit there and you look out like she does across the world, it's incredible. There is something so godly about it. It's like you really feel like you're the closest place to heaven.
And as far as I know, I mean, you mentioned earlier on that Everest, of course, came much later than Aconcagua, for example. But I think it's only 3 years after you started with free climbing, right?
Yeah.
So that's still pretty short amount of time.
Yeah, it was fast. I was completely dedicated.
Completely committed to it, yes.
Yeah. I did nothing else. All I did was, I worked to make the money and I didn't see any friends anymore. I had no boyfriend. I had no more yoga. I ran every morning. I went to the gym every night on the Stairmaster. I went on the climbing wall after that. I went back home. I ate. I started out the next morning. I was so single-minded during those 3 years.
if you look back to this time today, does it in any shape or form surprise you, the kind of turn that you gave your own life?
No. I think I was ready for something, yeah. I needed something to change in my life then, at that time, yeah, yeah. I think before I had done was work and make good career and very successful career as well. I was studying, and living in New York is quite hard. I mean, it's a really hard town where there's a lot of competition, and you have to prove that you're willing and able every day, and that you're willing to give more and do more and work harder than all the others. And I think it gave me the freedom to enjoy life for the first time in New York. I mean, to go out and to find a balance to this crazy fashion world and find peace and quiet in the mountains and solitude and just put your feet back on the ground. I think that's what the mountains gave me, and maybe a very crazy way of being so high and so far away. But for me, I really needed that balance. And I think it, I'm so glad I found it. I don't think I would have survived in New York otherwise.
Yeah. It's a tough place to, you can be easily absorbed in there, I think, right? Yeah, so that gave you.
You get lost in New York. People get lost. You work too much. A lot of people don't find a balance, especially if you have, I mean, I was in my late 20s. I had no partner. I had no kids. No, I was not married. I didn't have a personal balance in anything. All I ever did was work. So it's very one-sided, New York. It's beautiful, and it's the most incredible place on earth, but it's very one-sided. You have to really fight to find a balance.
Of course, you, in the end, finished, in quotation marks, the seven summits. You did all of them. One of them, I think, was very special to you, which is Mount Vinson in Antarctica.
Yeah.
It's the coldest of them all, probably.
Yeah.
And, I think it also meant a lot to you to be in this wilderness in Antarctica. Can you talk about that a little bit?
It was funny because I knew nothing about Antarctica when I started out. I probably wouldn't even have registered Antarctica as a continent. It was just that frizzly white thing at the bottom of the maps. I had no idea how big it is and how grand. And then nobody lives there. It's covered with ice, huge amounts of ice. And it's only penguins and some scientists who live around the edges of the continent. When I first started reading about it, I thought, this is surely the bleakest and most boring place in the world. I mean, what is there? Ice and a couple of mountains, that's it. And I went there with really, if I didn't have the seven summits, I would have never gone there, never in my life. And it was one of the most beautiful places I've ever seen. It's incredibly peaceful, and it's just white. There is just glacier, but the glacier is not flat. It has hills in it and movement, and these mountains that are poking their heads out of the glacier, they look like they were just born. They're all fresh and new. And it's incredible standing at, we had made two base camp and then two high camps on the mountain. And the higher you go, the further you can look out across the world. And it's, at first, I always thought that, I was looking out across the clouds, like you do in the Alps. Sometimes you have these really grisly days in Munich, then you drive out, you climb up and suddenly you're above the clouds and you have this beautiful vista. And in Antarctica, it also felt like that, only it was not clouds. It's the glacier. It's incredible. And there is something really peaceful there because the sun never goes down. It shines day and night in an Arctic summer. And it's not that it's warm, but every day feels like an incredibly long summer day. It really has that summer feeling of, oh, it doesn't matter if we have a little more breakfast and we set out later or come back later or earlier. There is such freedom of time there. There's no clock ticking, and there's incredible solitude and quietness for the soul. And I've never returned from any mountain expedition more peaceful and more relaxed than I did from Antarctica.
We talked about swiftly that you also, of course, have been involved successfully in the business world. And mm-hmm. in some shape and form, you are still involved in it mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. you appear regularly as a keynote speaker, especially yeah. before companies. Mm-hmm. What do you think are some of your experiences and learnings from which managers can benefit, but maybe also other people mm-hmm. in their personal life? Mm-hmm.
I think the mountains, and especially for me, Mount Everest is a great metaphor for anything great that we dare in life. It's teamwork. It's about being able to work with different people in your team, getting to know them, building some kind of an openness and a caring surrounding so you actually care for others and are able to deal with weaknesses and strengths and bring yourself into the team, then it's all about leadership, about leading the team, making the right decisions, planning the mountain really well. It's like there's no mountain, no high mountain that you climb in one walk up to the summit or in one day. You know, yes. you always have need very careful planning. You need a really strong base camp on which shoulders you climb the mountain. And then there's all this up and down, a lot of setbacks you have to endure. You have to rise up again and pull yourself together and try out and start new. And I think there's a lot of there's a lot of parallels on the mountain to great projects in real life, anything in companies, but also in your personal life.
What was it about mountains that always attracted you more than other kinds of landscapes, like deserts or jungles, which also can pose interesting challenges?
Yeah, that's true. I asked myself the same question when I first started out. I don't like the heat. Mm-hmm. I don't do well in the heat. I have a low blood pressure, and when I go and it's very hot, I don't do well. So I don't like mosquitoes and animals and all these insects flying around. Of course, nobody does, but in the mountains, you're safe. Mm-hmm. The air is fresh and clear, and what I really like about the mountain is the focus on one goal. You mm-hmm. sit at base camp, and I also like going in the little mountains in the Alps. But I really love these big expeditions where you set out with the team. You come to base camp, you organize yourself, you devise your route, you set in the different hike camps, and then you train, and then you go to the summit. I think there's something really magic about spending time on a great project in very much exclusivity where you don't get distracted by other things. I think that's what always brings me back to high mountains is going out for 2, 3, 4 weeks and focusing on one goal with one team.
Did you continue to do that after you had children, or did you adapt your choice of expeditions and of objectives a little bit?
Yeah, I had to adapt. Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Because the way you phrased it, the risk that you took was not that great anyway, because you could turn around anytime.
Yeah, I still believe that. I don't think I have ever taken great risks in the mountain. I've always made sure that before I went on an expedition, that I was very clear in my mind that I was ready to turn around and go back home. I always chose goals where I really wanted to go, like the Indian Himalaya, or I don't go to the same style of mountain every time, because I think it doesn't get boring, but I think you lose your respect. Mm-hmm. So I try to go to very different settings in the mountains. And I always make sure that I like everything about the expedition, or potentially I could like everything. The food and the people and the culture and the environment and the whole package. And not just the summit. I don't think I ever went for a mountain just to come home with the summit trophy. I think that's really important, because it makes you appreciate all the details on the mountain, and not just, and then you don't strive so exclusively just for the summit, and maybe go into risks that you shouldn't be taking. So that I think is something you have to do before at home. And with the children, of course, I didn't do as far and as high anymore, mm-hmm. obviously. I mean, I would break my heart. Even now they're 13 and 14, but it would break my heart to spend too much time away from them. I mean, more than 3-4 weeks is really hard. So I try, and I try to go when they're on vacation and my husband can take over so they don't feel I'm really gone. And yeah, it's restricting in many ways, but I think it's fine. There's so much in between.
And yet the objectives that you set yourself back then, mm-hmm. they were so ambitious, and you are also probably ambitious yeah. in your fashion career. So yeah. where do you take your ambition today? Are there still kinds of borders, maybe different kinds of borders, that you would like to cross or to overcome?
Yeah, my ambition is maybe not so technical anymore, that I want to do really very technically challenging climbs that no one has done before. Or I think it's more, I choose my goals differently now. I'm mostly I'm really curious about the places I want to go to. I've been thinking about Mongolia for so long now, and I really want to go there. I've heard and read and talked with some climbers who've been there, and I've heard such amazing stories that really opened my heart, and I'm really looking forward to going there. So it's usually with every mountain, it's like that. You hear a little bit something, then you see some pictures, then maybe on Instagram something, and you save it, and you dive a little deeper, you hear someone who's been there, and then your heart just sets flames, and then you want to go. So that's mostly what happens.
So that's how the story keeps continuing.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. I'm onto the holy mountains now.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
Nice.
It's sacred mountains, which is incredible. It's even more beautiful because it integrates more the myths and the legends and the people and their traditions.
And is that also mountains. Focused on the Buddhist countries around the Himalayas?
Or? No. They're everywhere around the world. Not so many in Europe, mm-hmm. I have found, but there's a lot of them in Africa, and in the Middle East, in the Himalayas, obviously. And, there's, well, if you look closely, there is a lot of mountains that are sacred and holy to the people who live there.
Nice. Well, that sounds like a potential sequel to our interview as well in
yes.
a few years. I thank you so much for making the time this time. It was a pleasure to meet you once again. We yeah. already have met some years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I thank you very much for your time. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thank you for great questions.
Thanks,
Eric.
Bye.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.